Welcome to our presentation today. We're extremely fortunate to have the fairly recently arrived superintendent of Yellowstone National Park with us today. His name is Dan Wenk. He's given up a nice comfy desk and chair in Washington, where it's warm and sunny, to come out here to the wilds of Wyoming and Montana. And he's got all these problems that he probably didn't have in Washington. He's got wolves to deal with and bison. There's the snowmobile problem, the lake trout problem, decaying infrastructure. He's got to plow the roads. I'm told from people who worked with him in the past that in a year or two, all these problems will be solved. The superintendent is going to tell us how he's going to do it.
Thank you for the a very optimistic introduction. It's wonderful to be here, but just I'm curious how many folks in the room here may have worked with or had an association in their careers with Yellowstone National Park. Well, we have a few, so I'll have to be careful not to tell any stories, only the facts. It really is great to be back in Yellowstone. Some of you may know a little bit about me. Let me just give you a little background. Is I lived and worked in Yellowstone between October of 1979 and August of 1984. At the time, I had the opportunity to be a management assistant to two superintendents, John Townsley, and then Bob Barbie. And Bob Barbie, as many of you may know, still is a resident of the Bozeman community. I never thought, you know, when you're growing up in the Park Service, I don't think you ever think you're going to get the chance to be the superintendent of Yellowstone. For some of us, maybe we're crazy enough to hope we get the opportunity to be the superintendent of Yellowstone, but it truly is a pleasure to be back in the park. And I didn't know really that I wanted to come back to the park until in my old job. I was a deputy director for operations of the Park Service, so while I didn't have those problems directly, I was still dealing with wolves, bison, winter use, etc. back in Washington. But they weren't my problems on a daily basis. They were my problems on the occasional call of a congressman or a senator or a member of the administration. But I think it was in 2008, I was asked to come out by Superintendent Lewis, and I was asked to come out and I was asked to help dedicate the new Justice Center in Mammoth. And I left in 84, and I'd been back on sort of rare occasion. I'd been back with my family to visit. I came back when Bob Barbie left for his retirement party. But I hadn't come back a lot in that period of time. And I flew into Bozeman, rented a car, and I was driving down through Paradise Valley. And it never had happened to me before, but I drove through Yankee Jim Canyon. And I was probably struck by the power of place like I'd never been struck before. And I literally pulled my car off to the side of the road, and I called my wife. And I said, "Barbara, it's amazing." I said, "I feel like I'm coming home." And two of our three children were born when we lived in Yellowstone, born here in Bozeman. And it was as powerful of a moment as I've ever had in my life. And at that time, I didn't know that I was going to have a chance to come back to Yellowstone. But when the chance did come, when Suzanne announced her retirement, I went to my bosses, and I, as a deputy director, you almost can tell them where you would like to go next in your career. But I had the chance, and they allowed me to come to Yellowstone. And I got here in February of last year, the end of February, and it's truly been an amazing spring and summer. And the issues in Yellowstone, the people in Yellowstone, the support for Yellowstone, the passion for Yellowstone is tremendous. Someone asked me in the recent past, you know, how do you deal with all the controversy? How do you deal with being a target? And my response was that some people think I'm overweight. It's just thick skin, you know. And you have to have a bit of thick skin, you know, as a superintendent of Yellowstone. But let's talk about some of the issues, or let's talk about some of the things that that are going on here. But let me put it in context first. When I left Yellowstone in 1984, you know, I know that when I came back, it's a different place. And just look how the world's changed in that period of time. In 1984, there was a company called PC Apple, run by Steve Jobs, that introduced the first Apple Macintosh computer in 1984. Ronald Reagan was president. Average income was about $21,000 a year. The average price of a home was $86,000. The other thing that was sort of magic about that year is only eight bison migrated out of the north entrance of the park. Some of the big issues, and we'll talk about today, and I'll be happy to take questions at the end of this. I'll try not to spend all your time listening to me. But we're going to talk a little bit about grizzly bears. We're going to talk about wolves. We're going to talk about facilities. We're going to talk about cutthroat trout, winter use, visitor management, and a little bit about the budget. And we all know what's going on in Washington, D.C. And a lot of the projects, or a lot of the problems or controversy in Yellowstone, you can really, somebody on my staff keeps talking about them in terms of, you know, well, the calculus of that. Well, I've come to determine that there's some things you can relate a lot of the problems in Yellowstone to math. You know, some of it is simple math, and some of it's advanced calculus. The simple math, you know, let's talk about the easy ones first. Let's talk about restoration of cutthroat trout. It really is simple math. If you go back to the early 1980s, it's estimated that there were about 4 million cutthroat trout in Lake Yellowstone. Today's estimate, about 500,000. The lake trout was discovered in Lake Yellowstone in 1994. And in 1995, we started a program to reduce the number of lake trout in Lake Yellowstone. And between 1995 and the end of last year, we'd removed about 500,000 lake trout from Lake Yellowstone. And why is that important? There are no natural predators for lake trout in Yellowstone Lake. Because of where they live, the depth in the lake that they live, the way they spawn, they don't use the rivers. They're not a food source for grizzly bears, for eagle, for osprey, for otters. You know, they're not part of that web of life, if you will. And they've replaced the cutthroat trout in many places, so the spawning streams aren't being used by the cutthroat trout. So cutthroat was not an important food source anymore for those other species. So we really have had to concentrate efforts. This year, we redoubled our efforts on the lake. We hired commercial fishermen, not to sell fish commercially, but because they have the ability to really catch large volumes of fish. We have our own boats. And on Lake Yellowstone this summer, we will have removed this summer about 225,000 lake trout from the population. Why that's important, I'm told. I was out on the boat about 3 weeks ago removing lake trout from the gill nets. We captured, in the three gill nets we pulled, we captured that day 554 lake trout. And because we can fish, if you will, or trap or net at different levels, at the same time we only captured about eight cutthroat trout. Lake trout, we opened up some of the lake trout to look at them. Female, I'm told, after this, for every pound of weight of a fish, they have about 900 eggs. We captured, not long ago, a 29-pound lake trout. That's a big fish. Do the math. 26,000 eggs in that one lake trout. Now, not all eggs will be fertilized, not all eggs will become fish, but a major source of food for a lake trout is cutthroat trout. That's what's happened. That's how they've driven down the population. We think there's somewhere between 350,000 and 500,000 lake trout in the lake right now. We're putting together a proposal, for the Yellowstone Park Foundation to help us restore the cutthroat trout. We're asking, it's the program overall that's going to cost about $2 million a year for 6 years to drive that population down. We're asking for help from the foundation to raise about $1 million a year for that 6 years. We know that we'll never eradicate the lake trout, but we believe we can drive the population down and we can get it to a point where it's going to be a maintenance program on the lake trout. So the other thing that's going on that's kind of high tech, if you will, is we've installed sonic transmitters into 141 lake trout. And we have receivers placed throughout the lake, and we're tracking where the fish go so that we can hopefully find their spawning beds. So if we can find their spawning beds, which are in the lake, then we can remove the fish before they become breeding, before they, we can get them when they're young, and hopefully that can have a major impact on the restoration of cutthroat trout. So that one's simple math. You reduce the number of lake trout and you increase the number of cutthroat trout. Let's talk about winter use. Winter use, I'd say in the scale of things, is maybe advanced algebra. It's not up to the level of calculus, but it's winter use has been going on for about well over 10 years. We've had 6 environmental documents that have been completed. We've spent over $10 million, and we still don't have a solution. And I just pushed the pause button. We went out to the public earlier this spring and asked, we had a preferred alternative. That preferred alternative would have allowed 330 snowmobiles at a max. It would have allowed 78 snow coaches. It would have put some restrictions on the technology that could be used, time of entrance, and it also had some variable use that were preset. Well, the public comment period did exactly what public comment is supposed to do. It pointed out some things that we didn't consider as fully as we should have considered. It pointed out some errors in some of the analysis that we did, and it pointed out some things that needed us to address them further. So I actually, I pushed the pause button and basically said, we are not going to try to finish this year and rush to a conclusion. The reason we're not going to do that is because it's my opinion, if we would have rushed to a conclusion, we would have been immediately taken to court by whichever side the final decision felt they were didn't favor, and they would have been able to win in court because our analysis wasn't complete and we'd be back to the drawing board again. So what we're going to do is the preferred alternative in the proposed rule had a provision in it that was for a transition year, that the winter of 11-12 would be at the same levels and the same services that had been provided the 2 previous years. And so we're going to implement just that portion of the preferred alternative and just that portion of the proposed rule. And then we are immediately, and we'll have that done in time for the winter season to begin. And so the winter season will begin December 15th. Of 2011, and then we will immediately begin a supplemental environmental impact statement. And the things that we're going to analyze that really were brought up in the public comment, that really, as I said, the public comment did what they wanted to do, or it should do, we had over 58,000 comments that had letters or pieces of correspondence that had 165,000 different comments in those, which when we reduced them to themes, about 150 themes about things that they thought we should look at or look at differently. Some of the big issues, air quality monitoring. We asked in our document, or we stated in our document, that starting in 2014, all snow coaches would have to meet EPA standards for a type tier 2 vehicle, which basically would be much of the snow coaches you see, you also could see on the roads here in Bozeman. They see them as shuttle buses, etc. And actually, they're used in the summer by many of the same drivers or companies that provide summer tours and winter tours. Unfortunately, or fortunately, the Tier 2 standards are based on wheeled vehicles on roads. What we don't know, under the additional stresses of tracked vehicles over snow, if we actually have the ability to meet that 2010 standard for EPA. So we have to make sure if we're setting a standard, we actually have a standard that can be met by somebody who puts a vehicle on the road. sound modeling. The work that's been done in Yellowstone over the last 10 years that's reduced the number of snowmobiles, cleaned it up through best available technology or BAT technology, and provided guides, has eliminated a lot of the issues for most of the people who visit the park. But the one park that seems to continue, or the one issue that seems to continue to be talked about, is noise or sound. And so the real question is are we looking at noise and sound correctly? We need to look at when we modeled sound, we modeled the existing fleet for snow coaches. We didn't model the technology that we said we were going to require in 2014. So we have to go back and do that correctly. The other question is, are we thinking about sound correctly? And I'll say it this way, that if one of the alternatives was to eliminate snowmobiles and to allow for 120 snow coaches, if you, in the current circumstance, where we have 78 snow coaches and 318 snowmobiles, that translates to entrances into the park by a snow coach or a group of snowmobiles of about 110 groups of vehicles. So the question is should we throw out whether they're snowmobiles or snow coaches and just talk about sound? And should we just allocate sound events and let the market determine whether or not it's a group of snow coaches or a group of snowmobiles or a snow coach? Here's an example why. If you're standing on a road between West Entrance and Old Faithful, and a group of snowmobiles go by, and I'm going to give you these for illustrative purposes only. These are not actuals. But if you're standing there and a group of snowmobiles go by, you'd hear that group of snowmobiles for about 3 minutes and 30 seconds from beginning to end. If you're standing there and a snow coach goes by, you'd hear that snow coach for about 3 minutes and 10 seconds. So the question is, does it matter if the sound comes from snowmobiles or snow coaches, but what's the best way to manage sound? And should we allocate sound events, or should we worry about whether or not it's a snow coach or a snowmobile? And we didn't analyze it that way. We analyzed it on the basis of numbers of vehicles, not on the basis of what is the best way to control sound in Yellowstone National Park. So we need to do that. We had the preset variable use limits, where some days it was 330 snowmobiles, other days 110, some days 78 snow coaches, some days as low as 30. I can guarantee you, I haven't found anyone comment yet that liked that. So we need to rethink that whole issue if we're going to have preset limits. 10:30 entry time. There's a lot of things that happen with weather in and around Yellowstone. If groups are coming down up from Jackson, down from Big Sky, down from Bozeman, is 10:30 really realistic, or is that a time that we should get rid of? We had a limit in there for pounds per square inch of how much a snow coach could weigh, because it was not an issue for snowmobiles. How much a snow coach could weigh, because we were concerned about the rutting of roads and the way that it made difficult to groom and to keep up. But we picked the number of 4.5 pounds. I can't find where that 4.5 pounds came from and how we know that the weight was the issue or was it the grooming that was the issue? When and how we groomed, or was it the weight? So we need to do further analysis. Sylvan Pass. Obviously it's been a very contentious issue, but the bottom line is we did not do the analysis that we needed to do to support either keeping it open, which was in our preferred alternative, or the analysis that might lead to a different decision. So we have to do further analysis on the wildlife impact. We have to do further analysis on the visitor and staff impact of keeping it open. We really didn't analyze what kind of impact on wildlife it was from shooting howitzers into the drifts and having them come down. We just need to do a more robust analysis of that. And then one other thing, I'm just giving you the highlights. The other big thing was we talked about commercially guided, which is what we have now, and unguided. There was a big push in a lot of the comments to analyze non-commercially guided. And what I'll say about that model is, if you want to float down the Grand Canyon on the Colorado River, 90%, maybe 95% of the people go with commercial guides. However, you can, through a lottery process, if you have your own equipment, your own raft that meets the standards, you can apply for a permit, you go through training and you're licensed. Or you're certified, whatever the right word is. So if any of you have a BAT snowmobile and you want to go tour Yellowstone National Park and you're willing to take a class on safety, on wildlife, disturbance, et cetera, should you as an individual be allowed to take your own snowmobile and go in if it meets the or should you be required to go with a guide? And we didn't analyze that. So that's another big issue. So we push the pause button. We're going to move forward with the same plan as we said we would for 11 and 12, which is the past 2 years, and we're going to try to come up with over the next 6 months a sustainable decision. We're going to do further analysis of these and other issues that I didn't mention to try to get that decision that will actually take us well into the future and not take us to the courts. No guarantee. Now we're going to get into calculus. Bison management. When I arrived at Yellowstone in February of this past year, obviously it was a very difficult winter, a lot of snow. The bison had been out of the park since December of 10. Not in great numbers, but they were coming, and more were coming every day. Many people, it was obviously the this story plays out in the press. Many people ask me, what are you going to do? And I said, well, I intend to have some conversations. I've got a meeting set up with the governor, and I'll be talking to the governor, and we'll hopefully come up and figure this out. And what I didn't realize at the time is I didn't realize the extent of Montana's open meeting laws. And I arrived at my meeting with the governor, and there were 3 television cameras and 6 print media in the room with the governor and me and his dog. And it's very difficult to have the kind of discussion, you know, that was that you might need to have in that kind of a situation. But that's the situation we were in. But we made great progress that day. Some people will call it progress, others may not. The progress we made is the governor said that they'd work with us to increase the surveillance zone by about 70,000 acres. That they were going to put in the buffalo buffer, as the governor called it, which is the cattle guard that you see at the south end of Yankee Jim Canyon, and that we were going to have more tolerance in the Garden Basin than we'd had in the past. And in fact, there were more bison in the Garden Basin walking, grazing throughout the basin. We probably had about 900 plus or minus bison that were in the Gardner Basin last winter. And probably about 600 of those were in our capture facility at Stevens Creek, and probably the other 300 were going through the Gardner Basin. Very controversial locally. There was property damage issues by the bison and by personal property owners or private property owners. Safety concerns by people who had not had, if you will, to live with bison. So we're continuing to work on that. We're working. We have the Forest Service, U.S. Forest Service, Animal Plant Health Inspection Service. APHIS is part of that. The National Park Service. We have 2 Indian tribes, as well as the Interagency Bison Council. We have the Department of Livestock and the State Veterinarian are all part of the Interagency Bison Management Plan. And we will continue to work to try to find a way to have bison on the landscape. We know this winter right now, when we went into last winter, we had about 3,900 bison in Yellowstone National Park. This winter, going into this winter, we have about 3,700. We're told that the winter's lining up much the same this year as it was last year, that the weather patterns are favoring La Nina, which is the same weather patterns as last year. We have done population models. We believe that that there will be a large migration out of the park once again. the tools that had been available to us before in terms of culling bison, which have been we've been shipping them to slaughter, primarily for use by the Native American communities for nutritional and cultural purposes. We didn't have those tools last year because the governor had an executive order from February 15th to May 15th, which prohibited us from shipping bison on Montana roads. The Interagency Bison Management Council, or team, excuse me, will continue to meet, and we'll continue to find out, try to figure out how we are going to deal with the bison on the landscape this winter. A major difference that this has caused, for those of you familiar with Yellowstone National Park, this summer we had about 2,300 bison on the northern range. Those bison that spend most of their time, if you will, in the Lamar Valley in the summer, and that's the most bison ever on the northern range. We had about 1,400 on the central range. We have the disease issues that we have to deal with in terms of brucellosis. One of the things that we do in the capture facilities, we capture bison, we vaccinate bison. We also have the ability to determine which animals have the greatest disease prevalence, and we could ship those bison to slaughter. That would be an effective tool to deal with the disease and disease management. But we do know, because bison do not have an unlimited ability to range and migrate outside of Yellowstone National Park, we do know that we have to take a certain, there has to be a population reduction. We work with Montana Department of Game, Fish, and Parks for a hunting season, which they have. We also have tribal hunts outside of the park, and those happen outside of the park, and that's an effective tool that has to be part of bison management. The question is can those tools take enough bison out of the population, or do we need to cull or remove bison by shipping them to slaughter, or shipping them to reestablish bison herds in other places in Montana? So that's the calculus one. There's more moving parts on that than one might normally think. A very brief couple words on grizzly bears. When I left Yellowstone in 1984, I think in the population of grizzly bears in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem was about 150 bears total. Now there's 600 plus grizzly bears in the ecosystem, and probably over 150 in Yellowstone National Park alone. As many of you know, we had the first two fatalities caused by grizzly bears within Yellowstone National Park this summer. The first one was on just south of Canyon, the Wapiti Lake Trail. Mr. Mattioshi and his wife were hiking on that trail. They observed grizzly bears. Let me back up. They'd hiked in the park four or five times before. They made a decision to hike and this time. And I'm really not trying to blame the victims. I'm just trying to tell you what happened. They didn't carry bear spray, which is something we recommend. And they hiked about a quarter mile out onto the trail, and they observed a grizzly sow and two cubs about 300 yards to their south. They actually watched, took pictures, photographed the grizzly and cubs for probably 10 to 15 minutes, and then they proceeded down the trail. They went about a mile and a half and decided that the mosquitoes were too harsh, too bad, and they turned around and came back on the trail. Those of you familiar with the trail, you may know it's a loop trail. But they came back. In the period of time that they came back, the sow and the cubs had moved up and back into the path that they had left. They observed the bears from about 100 yards away, and they did what they should do. They backed out of the area. After they backed for a while, they turned and they started to walk away, and they turned and looked over their shoulder, and they observed the grizzly bear coming towards them. I think they interpreted that action as a charge, and they ran. And when they ran, we can tell from the evidence on the ground that the grizzly bear, if you will, kicked it into high gear and chased them down. Mr. Mattioshi was killed. Mrs. Mattioshi suffered no injuries. So I made a decision that I was not going to remove the grizzly bear because it was, in our opinion, based on the evidence, a defensive attack. It was not a predatory action at all. Once the perceived threat by the bear had been removed, The bear left and went, you know, and left the area. We observed the bear for most of the summer. We saw what her actions were in the cubs, and we were very comfortable. Come August 26th, I think is the date, a body was discovered along the Merry Mountain Trail, the second hiker. The second hiker was hiking alone, did not have bear spray, and was found by two other campers probably within about 24 hours of what we think the time of death was. We do know from forensic evidence that there were definitely four bears on site, maybe up to seven. We also know at the end of the day we were able to determine that the grizzly sow that caused the first fatality was at the scene. We'll never know if that grizzly sow caused the death or had any active engagement with the body at all, but we know that the sow and two cubs were on the scene. My opinion, the grizzly bear program at Yellowstone National Park is more important than one bear. The population could sustain that loss. I did not want to take the risk of a future encounter and a future death with that sow. And so I made the decision to remove the sow and to put the cubs at the West Yellowstone Grizzly Discovery Center. Not an easy decision, I think, as you can imagine. But and as you can also imagine, it's very controversial. It's probably controversial in this room. And I'll be happy to answer questions. You know, some of the things, the lessons that we have learned from this is about messaging and how we let people know that they should carry bear spray, that they should travel in groups, they should make noise, you know, they should understand, you know, where they are and their the environment that they're hiking in. You know, how do we get the message out? How do we make sure people understand? When people backpack in Yellowstone National Park and camp overnight, we actually have a requirement for a positive contact where they come in, they get their backpacking permit, we can talk to them, we can sit down and say, these are the rules you need to live by in the backcountry of Yellowstone. Day hikers, we don't have that positive requirement that we sit down. So we're going to be spending a lot of time this summer trying to really figure out if we're doing it as well as we can or if there's ways that we can do it better. Visitor management. This is probably the second busiest year in the history of Yellowstone. We have, when I left Yellowstone in 1984, there was about 2.5 million visitors. When I understood there was going to be 3.6, I remembered my frustration in 1984 trying to go through the park to do business. And I was interested in how different it was going to be. Maybe it's age, mine. But I was not that frustrated, to be perfectly honest, by the visitors. I was, in terms of trying to get from point A to point B, certainly because of the wildlife reintroduction of the wolves and the recovery of the wolves in the park and the recovery of the grizzly bears, there's more animal jams. And some of them can be quite long, quite extensive. But I also noticed that most people who might have been frustrated when they were a quarter mile away from the bear or the wolf, when they got there, sort of that frustration disappeared because they were very, very happy and pleased to be able to see an animal in the wild. So, you know, what we're gonna do, how we're gonna manage visitors, I think our biggest challenge is some of the bear jams, animal jams. I think it's also trying to disperse the visitors over a wider part of the park. It's amazing the difference to me. I'm gonna go back to 84 and now. Lamar Valley, back in the early 80s, was sort of a treasure that was known, I think, to a lot of people who live locally, but was really not the magnet that it is now in terms of animal watching from people who come to Yellowstone that want and go out to Lamar Valley. So that's a lot different. Let's talk budget for a second, only because I get asked all the time. We don't know, you know, we're right now we have a continuing resolution that goes through the time of the work of the super committee. That continuing resolution basically has some cuts that are in it for our 2012 budget, but it's not, I think, and for the most part, it's not going to be noticeable. to the average visitor, the cuts that we have for this coming year. However, nobody knows what's going to happen in 2013 and beyond after the work of the Super Committee in terms of what they do, what their recommendations are, and how budgets, domestic programs across the board, and defense are going to be cut. I do know this, that we are not going to be able to do, we certainly can't do more with less. I don't even think we can do the same with less. You know, it will have an impact. It will have an impact on when the park opens, when it closes, what kind of services are provided, you know, on a daily basis in the park. You know, we will first and foremost make sure we protect the resources of Yellowstone National Park, and we'll provide for a great visitor experience. Until we know what those numbers are, until we know that if we're cut and how much, or if we're not cut at all, I really can't say what those impacts are going to be. I've been asked many times in surrounding communities, don't you understand how that affects our economy? In places like West Yellowstone and Cody, probably especially, that are gateway communities to the park. And my response is, I absolutely understand that it affects your economy. I'm concerned about your economy. I care about your economy, but we're not responsible for your economy. You know, so it's very personal. You know what happens in the parks, and I understand that. But I also understand that our obligation is to Yellowstone National Park and the visitors who come there. The other thing I tell the local communities tonight is that the Park Service will never try to provide all the services and facilities within a park that are required. We look to gateway communities. We look to surrounding communities to provide lodging facilities, restaurants, you know, other attractions, you know, to serve the visitors as well. But it has to be a partnership. And I think we have great partnerships. One of the things I just when I was in Washington, I was known for having rules, and I had a few rules, but I think they're applicable here in Yellowstone as well. One of my rules is, I don't know if this is a rule as much as, you know, when you know what your values are, it's not hard to make decisions. You know, one of the things I'm going to try to do is be in the community so people understand my values, understand the basis for why we make the decisions we make, and hopefully that will help people. If they understand our values, they'll understand the decisions. The last couple years I was in Washington, it was with the previous administration, the Bush administration. The first couple years was obviously with the Obama administration. I was acting director for about 9 months during the change of administrations. I had a saying in the previous administration. It was because, and this is how it has seemed to me, the things that they couldn't get accomplished in the previous 7 years, they wanted to accomplish in the last year, you know, because that's how all administrations are. So my saying at that time was, nothing's impossible to those who don't have to do it. Then the new administration came in. And they had great plans. And I changed that to, everything is possible to those that don't yet know what they're talking about. But that's you know, I'd be happy to answer questions, but that's sort of, if you will, the highlights of my first 7 months. The first 7 months have gone, it seems like I've been here a long time, and at the same time, it's gone very, very quickly.